Now we come to the last presentation today. Oh, wow. Am I looking forward to it? Sort of. First of all, let me say how much I owe to my wife, Elizabeth. As I pointed out, she's been one of my teachers throughout my life. I'm not terribly good at spelling, and so she does all the writing. And it's really nice to stand behind her and say, God, you do write so beautifully. So when we do books together, I usually do the science, she does the writing, and I think that's really a nice partnership. I like that. Any rate, she is going to fill the gaps, and then my daughter will fill some more gaps, oh God.
Well, first of all, can you hear me? I'm not used to this in my face. First of all, thank you all so very much for coming. It's been a fantastic day with all bits of our past life flashing before our eyes. It's been rather like Desert Island Discs without the music. But a huge part of what has made our working life and Peter's research so enjoyable and so much fun for both of us has been the people you've heard speaking today, who've been not only valued colleagues, but like so many people in this audience, they've all become good friends. But there are one or two gaps in this interesting and varied career that you've heard about, which I feel I should fill in to give you a more rounded picture of the man and his work. And perhaps I should begin with what, as far as I'm concerned, was the beginning. We met in Cambridge, outside the anatomy schools, where for the third time that day, I was pumping up my bicycle, which had a slow puncture. In those days, in Cambridge, there was a male-female ratio of about 10 to 1, and a maiden in distress seldom had very long to wait before some Sir Galahad galloped, hopefully, to her rescue. So when a couple of guys approached, I paused for a moment and mopped my brow. Oh dear, said one of them, a tall, friendly-looking fellow. Have you got a puncture? Yes, I said. He gave me that look of mingled compassion and understanding, which his patients all came to value so highly. And he said, oh, what bad luck. And passed on. By the time we married, he'd qualified and abandoned the idea of brain surgery as being a bit mechanical and boring and settled for psychiatry. His first psychiatric job was at Worley Hospital in Essex, one of those huge old-fashioned bins which don't really exist anymore, a few hundred or so burnt-out schizophrenics housed in massive dormitories, where, so far as I can see, the main form of therapy seemed to be looking after the staff. Care in the community in the 1960s was just a gleam in the eyes of the Department of Health, but I can assure you that the care we had in that community surpassed anything we've ever experienced before or since. It was a bit like Downton Abbey. We had Johnny, who did all the cleaning and the housework, and we had Lady Di, a very posh patient who did the ironing. And we had a couple of gardeners whose names I can't remember, but who frightened the living daylights out of my mother when she was staying with us. And she saw them coming towards her, carrying two garden forks, the ready like rifles. She was a bit uneasy, too, when Annabelle was born, our first child, and Johnny decided that taking her out for walks in her pram was a lot more interesting than doing the housework. So we swapped roles for a bit, and that seemed to work quite well, and I don't think it damaged her in the long run at all. But looking back, I can see that this year at Worley had a huge impact on the course of our life. To begin with, I'd like to just remember with fondness Peter's first consultant, Neville Copeland, who was about the best introduction to psychiatry he could have had. And Neville's influence lives on in our lives longer than he could have imagined. Neville was a very keen tennis player, and he used to say that whenever he found himself in a tricky situation during a match, he'd say, "What would Rod Laver have done?" The answer might be a right-hand cross-court shot to the back of the court, or up to the net and an overhead smash. But sometimes, when he asked himself the question, the answer came through quite clearly. Rod Laver would never have got himself into this situation. And ever since then, many of the trickier moments in our life have been referred to as Rod Laver moments. It was at Worley, too, that Peter learnt his basic psychiatric tools and practiced them on his family. He psychometrically tested me and any members of my family he could get his hands on and gave us IQ tests, presumably to check the gene pool. I never discovered the benchmark against which a marriage could be declared null and void. He gave both of us aptitude tests, which showed only that I scored appallingly on clerical work, but his score was even worse, which explains why it's always been considered my job to send out the Christmas cards and pay the bills, and why our study is such a disorganized mess. And he's always had, as I think other people have mentioned, a natural interest in the sort of stuff that many of us take for granted so long as it's working. The television set that I can't remember one of the speakers referred to, which he made when he was at school, was about the size of a shoebox with a greenish screen which still sits in our attic, and we watched the results of the 1959 general election on it. And so it was perhaps not surprising that during our year at Worley, his interest in the newfangled world of computers was aroused. The first programming language designed to communicate instructions to computers had only been written in the 1950s. And in 1964, Peter decided to go on a computer programming course. This caused a certain amount of raised eyebrows and puzzlement amongst family and friends. "He's a doctor," said my mother, and she was not the only one. "What does he want to know about computers for?" And our children will tell you how much of their childhood weekends were spent on trips to the London University Atlas computer, one of only three ever built, which occupied most of the house in Gordon Square. They didn't complain about it too much because the uniformed fat man on the door had a seemingly endless supply of sweets in his pocket, and the computer output provided a seemingly endless supply of paper for drawing. Being a bit of a Luddite myself, it took me approximately 20 years to acknowledge the charm of the computer. But then, sometime in the early 1980s, a friend showed me how these weirdo machines could effortlessly scissors and paste stuff back, and how you didn't have to zing the thing back at the beginning like a typewriter at the end of every line. And so I guess it was about the next day that we went out and bought one. One part of his career, which I always found one of the most fascinating areas of his work, and which hasn't been mentioned at all today, and that is his work as a medical expert witness. I think maybe we've both always had a touch of the Perry Masons in our makeup. And because his medical specialties were sleep disorders and epilepsy, we had innumerable cases of men who had accidentally murdered their wives or mothers-in-law during sleepwalking or an epileptic episode. We had Sullivan, who killed a neighbor during an epileptic seizure and whose case clarified the law on epileptic automatisms. And we had the Mardi Gras bomber, who for 4 years terrorized Barclays Bank and Sainsbury's by leaving rather inadequate homemade bombs in plastic bags outside their branches. He lacked the qualities of a first-class criminal mind because what he used for disguise was a very obvious wig and a paper bag held in front of his face. And in 1997, he was involved in the posthumous appeal of Derek Bentley, who was actually hanged in 1953 for the murder of a policeman, despite the fact that he hadn't fired the shot. It had been his friend. Bentley was granted a posthumous pardon in July 1998. And I think I seem to remember that conviction was down to Judge, whatever his name was, Goddard, the killing judge, who was a great, I think, block on the legal profession. But Fenwick's first case was rather lower key than those. His first opportunity to shine in the courts came one day when, driving our rather large and unwieldy Dormobile camper van round Cambridge Circus, I got my back bumper tangled up with the front bumper of a taxi. And Peter discovered that instead of settling out of court, we could fight the case ourselves in the county court. And so 18 months later, because litigation is a fairly drawn-out affair, we all turned up in the Croydon County Court. The taxi driver had his solicitor with him, and I had Peter, who had cancelled his outpatient clinic and was carrying my defence. This consisted of several large sheets of paper with scale diagrams worked out in the hospital car park to show the turning circle of our Dormobile, a plastic ice cream carton containing a series of little matchbox cars to add three-dimensional reality to the diagrams, and a few photographs of me trying to measure the width of Cambridge Circus in the middle of the traffic, and looking very embarrassed, as indeed I was. We also had with us a very young apprentice barrister, the pupil of a friend of ours, who'd been sent along because our friend thought it would be educational for him. The taxi driver sat on one side of the court and we settled down on the other, respectively separated like friends of the bride and groom. The judge was a very tetchy lady with a disconcerting habit of burying her face in her hands as though anxious to get away from it all when anyone said anything she disapproved of, which was often. Within a very short time, she'd reduced both the taxi driver and me to a state of nervous idiocy by pouncing on various grey areas and inconsistencies in our respective accounts of the incident, which had happened over a year before. We cast each other glances of sympathy, and both of us started backtracking a bit to corroborate each other's stories, which made her crosser than ever. I'd have called the whole thing off and settled there and then if it hadn't been for Peter sitting beside me there, so eager and well-prepared. When his turn came, he sprang up and spread all his evidence on a table in front of the judge, who buried her head in her hands again. Then he explained about the turning properties of Volkswagen vans and proved how impossible it was for me to have hooked my bumper into the taxis by cutting in front of him, as he said I did, but that it could have happened if I'd been turning left down Charing Cross Road, as I said I was, and he had been driving too close to my back, as he said he wasn't. It was complex but impressive. After a while, the apprentice barrister passed me a note which read, "I don't think the judge is very mechanically minded, and I'm not at all sure she's following your husband's line of argument." After a while, the judge lifted up her head and said testily, just a minute, what are you? Are you an engineer?" "No," said my husband. "Well then," said the judge, "what do you do?" "I'm a psychiatrist," he said. She probably woke up several times during the night to think of witty responses she might have made, but at the time she was lost for words. However, in her summing up, she was nice to us all. She said that both the taxi driver and I were honest and intelligent witnesses, although she believed that one of us was mistaken in her memory of the event. She said that my husband was a man loyally springing to his wife's aid and congratulated him on the work he'd done on his defence, which she described as ingenious. Then she phoned for the taxi driver and said I'd have to pay £15 costs. Afterwards, the taxi driver and I shook hands and he said he'd been interested to hear about my husband's profession because his wife had a bit of a problem. So Fenwick switched persona and gave him, in his euphoric state, a very good consultation in the corridor. So Fenwick's first case might not have been a total victory, but as he said, £15 is a small price to pay for the hire of a courtroom for a whole morning with a judge and court officials thrown in. We've been working together much of the time since his official retirement about 20 years ago, and I can understand why in some relationships, some circumstances, it might put a considerable strain on a relationship. He's already mentioned why I'm such an invaluable part of the system. It may come as a surprise to some of you, though probably not to anyone who's paid careful attention to his emails or PowerPoint slides, to learn that after 20 years of working with palliative care teams, carers, bereaved families, in hospitals and nursing homes and hospices, of writing endless papers and giving countless lectures on end-of-life and near-death experiences, Peter still has to ask me every single time, how do you spell dying? So you can see why the writing partnership works. It's entirely non-competitive. He knows what to be said, and I know how to spell it. Not many people can be lucky enough to be able to finish their working lives, or rather start their retirement, I think, on a post-retirement high. And that we were able to do so has been entirely due to Andy sitting there, who spoke to you earlier today, who gave us 10 wonderful years from 2000 to 2010 in his unit in Japan, which I think was actually one of the best and happiest decades of our life. So very special thanks to you, Andy. And there is in Japan a fairly modern tradition, which I think started in about the 1990s, of the saizenzo, or living funeral. I looked this up in Wikipedia, and it says, the goal is for this to be happy, to celebrate a life, and to give thanks to everyone for attending. During a living funeral, families and friends will share stories and memories of the person. It's often a very happy event. The soon-to-be-deceased person often speaks about his or her life and who's had an impact on it. Friends and family of the person hosting the funeral will say things that they would have said at a normal funeral, except now their loved one is there to hear it. And I think that pretty well describes what's been happening today, something very akin to a saizenzo, though hopefully held rather prematurely. Wikipedia also points out that this saves the family the astronomical costs of a traditional funeral when the time comes. So Tris and me and Tash, when the time does come, remember that we've done the ceremonial wordy bit, and you can just settle for two cardboard boxes under the rowan tree. And now I'm going to hand over to Annabelle, who's going to give you the real picture, I think, probably, which I'm not totally looking forward to, family life.
Yes, I'm Annabelle. I'm Peter and Elizabeth's eldest child, and as often befalls the eldest child, I've been asked to say something about my parents. We've heard a lot of thought-provoking science today, and actually a lot of funny and sort of moving speeches as well. So I think now it's time for something completely different, a poem to my mum and my dad. There's a place far over the ocean where lions and elephants roam, and on a small Kenyan farm in 35, a boy called Peter was born. Now, a curious little lad was young Peter, and right from his earliest years, he got up to pranks and experiments that would have had most parents in tears. Why fish with a rod, he asked one day, when throwing a bomb in the pond. I have plenty of fish landing straight in my lap. It's better than even a wand. So to school, aged just four, all boarding alone, he recited a poem for fun about an Argentine cat, a sewing machine, and stitches in the poor cat's bum. This earned him a boxing across his small ears, but didn't dampen his spirits in the least. Yes, age nine, he protested that the food at his school was disgusting and in no way a feast. But deaf to the protest, no changes were made. And Peter decided that action was due. Rolling down his school socks and with cap inside out, he quietly sneaked out of the school. With no plan in mind, he trekked into the bush to bring his protest to an end. Exhausted and tired, and 10 miles from school, he was found by a family friend. Now, you'd think he'd grow wiser and give up the fun when off to England, age 13, he did go. But his mind turned to science and the tricks of the mind in his formative years at Stowe. He studied a book on hypnosis and decided to, just for a laugh, to use suggestion on a poor unsuspecting soul. In assembly, he said, please, have a bath. Clothes off in the great hall did not go down well. So he took to filmmaking instead, where Animal Farm was a school favourite hit, but on medicine his mind was now set. To Cambridge he went, all excited and new, where he met a young lass from the Shires. He fancied her rotten, but his poor chat-up line, as she struggled to pump her flat tyres, was, what bad luck, I hope you can fix them. See you around, but I really must go. And for better or worse, she married the man, and now begins the story you know. In search of the truth and the conscious divine, he decided to study the brain. Epilepsy, neurology, psychiatry and faith, blending new scientific terrain. Whilst working and writing and travelling the world, he still managed to be a great dad. We remember the things that made him so different and kind and wonderfully mad. The TVs piled high on the playroom floor, one for red, one for blue, one for sound. It was highly embarrassing for us children when visiting friends came round. We remember the day that he jumped on the tube and spoke to the driver with elation. How fast does it go? Will you show it to me? And obliging, the driver shot right past the station. We remember brains in the jars at the IOP and the monkeys up on the top floor, and the first London computer at Queen Square, and bananas from the man on the door. I remember with horror the story of Ruth, bringing hallucinations that haunted my teens, and my dad's bad sense of fashion, his crazy wild hair and his ankle-dangling jeans. And what of the time when for TV he said to my brother, who just turned 14, try for an out-of-body experience, my son, with the help of these gassies which cannot be seen. And what of the night we won't let him forget as he trialled equipment at an early stage, when he answered the door to the local police with his manhood wired up to a gauge. Have you seen a strange man around here? The young Bobby asked as he tried to avert his shocked eyes. I do beg your pardon, sir, but I think you should know there's some wires sticking out of your flies. I remember the day I sat my grade five and my dad was to sit his grade one. His sore disappointment of failure, keyboard silence, brought relief to most everyone. We remember the weekends of fright in his plane as we flew all the way to Calais, with Mum frozen in the front and our minds on the freets, and her promise all would be okay. But Dad being Dad, he has never sat still with inventions and all kinds of schemes. Windmills and turbines and masses of wire, and a house fit to burst at the seams with more and more gauges and lights that go flash. It's enough to send you quite mad, as the study lights flicker and you start to feel sick. It's only the phasing, says Dad. Along with his projects, he searched far and wide for a glimpse of the truth in the light. From Indian gurus to hovering monks and meditation for mindful insight. But how does he do it all, you may ask? And why does he not seem to stop? It's Mum by his side, his invincible scribe, his wonderful, nurturing prop. All through these years, typewriter to hand and translating his thoughts to the page, Mum has worked wonders with her true gift for words, her kindness undiminished by age. And she's cared for us children with laughter and love while reading or writing a book. Although she's killed the old cat, we'll forgive her for that, for she is the most wonderful cook. And her books tell the story of life, her words guiding us from birth through to death, not forgetting our teenage embarrassment at her books on having good sex. So, when all's said and done, it remains just to say, happy birthday to you, Dad and Mum. No stopping for you and your very good health for the years which are all yet to come.
Well, thank you so much. I didn't realize it was quite as bad as that. Any rate, we come to the end of the day, and so I have to thank you all very much for coming, and particularly to everybody, all my friends who have given talks today, and all of you who have come to wish us a happy birthday. It's been a magnificent day, and it's wonderful renewing old acquaintanceships. And so, we're going to now spend 5 minutes in meditation, because without a proper ending to a day like this, it just gets dissipated. So, 5 minutes of meditation, and the owl will bring us out with music. And again, let me thank you all so much for coming, because it's meant so much to all of us in the family. And I really am grateful to you. Thank you all very much.